This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Kevin Lowe,
Alison Malden,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Kevin, you were very closely involved with PEC in Marton.
I was. I was certainly not there at the inauguration of PEC, but I joined the company through an interesting series of events in the mid-1960s. I took a cadetship at the DSIR and learned and studied electronics. During that period, I became quite proficient at developing products that were aiding the scientific effort at DSIR, and I went through a period, a very interesting period in electronics, when there was the move from the valve technology to solid state or transistor technology, and I was one of not very many people around that had made that transition. It was quite recent.
That was also mid to late 60s. That was,
yes, that was about 1966, I think it was. Yes. I was shoulder tapped by the owner of PEC, which was a company in Marton that had been making a range of mechanical products, to see if they could marry their mechanical and manufacturing expertise with some high technology. And so I joined the company on a part-time basis in about 67, and finally moved from Lower Hutt, where I was working for DSIR, to Marton in about 1973. At that time, the company was making ploughs, they were making some gear oil pumps, and they had started making some petrol pumps that were used throughout New Zealand. The aim of the business changed at that point to try and incorporate some technology, firstly in their products and then moving on from there. So we married a little bit of my expertise with their production capability and obviously financials ability.
Was that very forward-looking at the time?
Yes, it was, because we started with several sort of unusual products. One was an electric fence unit. It was my very first role at PEC, was developing an electric fence unit. And that was reasonably revolutionary, in that prior to that point, electric fences used to be used for brake feeding and the like. So it was really restricted to fences of, say, a kilometre or less.
Brake feeding?
Where you'd put a very temporary fence up with just...
dividing up a large paddock.
Yes, dividing a large paddock with those little, they used to call them pigtail stakes that were put in the ground. We developed a very powerful electric fence that could almost electrify all the fences on a farm, and that was that was quite revolutionary, and it was quite a big seller for a long time. And electric fences obviously remain a pretty important part of farming in New Zealand and many other dry-ish countries. We went on from there to incorporate high-tech into petrol pumps themselves. At that point, the petrol pumps were made out of mechanical registers that used to spin around at a dreadful rate. I don't know whether you remember the numbers on drums that used to go around. And the difficulty is, as the cost of fuel rose, was that the drums got to run faster and faster until they just about disintegrated because of the speed the dollars were
the pumps were powered by electricity then?
They were electric pumps, yes. So we put electronic controllers into the pumps themselves, and that got rid of that problem, but it also gave us the opportunity of transmitting the information from the pump into the sales room, and that allowed a whole new range of ways of buying petrol, such as paying for it first, prepay, coin-operated pumps, note-operated pumps, and then finally card-operated pumps. And that was very novel, and the company was very successful with those products to the point that it grew quite rapidly. At the point I joined the company, there was about 35 or 40 staff. The number of people working there rose rapidly to somewhere around 200 during the period that we put electronics into petrol pumps. So it was a very rapid and typical technology driven company, I guess.
So originally it was a sort of mechanical process that turned the spindles?
Yes.
How did the electronic measurement come through?
The electronics was really only for the computing and the display part of it. The metering of the fuel, it was done by a positive displacement piston meter, and that was retained in the high technology version. So we were using an encoder or a transducer to detect the amount of fuel being dispensed through this positive displacement meter. Mm,
yeah. Was this sort of thing being done overseas at that time?
No, it wasn't really. We were one of the first people to encounter the problem, given that our fuel during the Arab oil shock of the 1974-75, something like that. We in New Zealand had some of the highest, some of the costliest petrol in the world at that point. And the price of fuel, I think, went up by a factor of four in about 2 years, if you remember it. I can certainly remember petrol at 30 cents a gallon. But it went up by a factor of four, and that put an awful lot of strain on the mechanical registers that were in petrol pumps at the time. And so I guess in New Zealand we had a greater need, and so we actually did it first. However, the need caught up in other countries, and the company was quite successful at selling those products. And
so you took out international patents?
Yes, we did, and we started selling those products in Australia, up into the islands. We were quite active in South America as well. That's where those products went. Countries, I guess, with similar product problems to ours, with the high price of Petra.
Now, just the thought of Marton, which was, I suppose, at that stage a fairly small place in New Zealand, very remote from many other places, the idea of a world-beating technology coming from there. Did you think you were taking a risk, taking the job with that company in the first place? And did you expect to be able to do something that might be so significant?
Yes, certainly there were concerns. I was a young married man at the time with a couple of children, or one child and one on the way. And there was definitely a risk, but it was there was a lot of excitement, and I was quite passionate about technology at the time, and still am, I guess. But I thought it was a risk worth taking. The company had started during the war by a young engineer that had come back from the war, and he must have come back early, because it was 1939 when the company was started, but the founder had been in the war, so he focused on a lot of products that used aluminium parts from aircraft that had been used in the war, crashed aircraft and the like, so that's the reason that the company was in Marton, and it was taking the aluminium from the air command at Ohakia. That's where a lot of old aircraft ended up.
So it's from the aircraft fuselage and so on.
Yes, and they melted down the aluminium.
Okay.
Yes. So the company had been established for quite a number of years. That was a comfort. Marton was an interesting choice, but one I'd been born and brought up in a city. Whilst the cities were very exciting, I'd got to a point of starting a family and was probably ready for a quieter life anyway. In fact, our family very, very much enjoyed living in a small rural community.
And what was the culture of the company then? Was there quite a group of innovative engineers, or you were on your own?
No, I was on my own. and in fact, there was no one else in the company that knew very much about any sort of technology or any... But were quite competent engineers. They had a very good tool room, and they made very good machine tools, pieces for lathes and mills that were useful in production of parts. However, it wasn't long after I joined that we started recruiting some very capable people. And in fact, at the end of the first three or four years that I was in the company, we'd probably recruited about 50 additional people, 50 additional solid-state electronic engineers.
That's massive. You virtually doubled the labour force of the company through...
Yes, and they were all in what we called R&D, which was really product development.
So there was some real vision in that company to do something.
To follow it. Yes, there was. Yes, there was some very strong impetus within the company. I guess you would have to say the company had always had an innovative spirit.
Yeah,
it just completely was devoid of the technology to make it happen. Until I arrived.
So you felt they were very open and receptive, and prepared to take risk and money.
Yeah, indeed. Mm. Yeah, and it was really the innovative spirit and the support that I got in creating a team around me, and then the support for that team that actually drove the success of the company.
So what was the process in deciding what to put the effort into? Did they say, oh, we think there's a good market for this, we'll try and develop something? Or
Indeed, yes. There was several things going on, I suppose. One was the founder's brother had founded a company making electric fences. That company's name was Electromagnetic Products. And that had gone for a little while with these little electric fences that had little mechanical wind-up motors in them, and they were being used for brake feeding or cutting up paddocks. But that had fallen on hard times, so that had been folded into PEC, and that was the impetus, I guess, to develop a new, more powerful electric fence unit. Then when it came to the fuel systems, the first few products were really being sold to exactly the same customers as their existing products. So there was a pretty clear direction there. We were following market leads. We were following what customers wanted, and we had very good connections with the industry.
So you got good feedback, and they were saying, we wish there was something that could.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yes. Yes.
So and they built up a sales team, or it just.
Yeah. Then there was a sales team built up. And some of the early days they were general salespeople, but latterly they became specialists in electronic technology themselves. Mm. That sales team, yeah. And the size of the company grew over say the first 10 years through the 70s and early 80s. To the point that we were exporting around 80% of everything we made. Mm. The company was named Exporter of the Year at one point, got an export award, and that was, and we were breaking a number of boundaries and those sorts of areas.
So what happened with this sort of technology in, say, Europe and the United States? Did they copy you, or something happened independently, or were you selling them?
No, I guess whilst we were very early into it, a lot of what we were doing was almost intuitively the right direction to go. So I imagine there were other people working on similar things throughout the world. We prided ourselves on being very quick to develop products and getting them into the market very quickly. So we seem to have the products on the market quickly. I suspect other companies, particularly the large American companies, had skunk work somewhere buried deep in their organisation, but did not have the right sort of innovative spirit.
Yeah, smaller firms can be more flexible and responsive.
Absolutely.
And was it also maybe the sometimes for innovation, if there could be a small niche market you can go for, and the large firms would say it's too small, so they go for them?
Yes, there wasn't quite so much of that. I really do put it down to the fact that we were small and nimble, and larger companies would have had a lot more political inertia to get new products when perhaps the need was not as great as the need was for us.
Nowadays, in the sort of 21st century, you hear innovative companies like Google that have a very radical culture and so on. Was PEC sort of quite formal or very relaxed, or what was the feel of working there?
We did have quite a radical culture for the era. We were doing things that no other companies were doing in terms of staff benefits, for example. We had a formal bonus system. It wasn't one that the boss decided at some point that it was time to pay a bonus. The bonus system was formal. We had a gym that was, and all members were encouraged, all staff members were encouraged to, and members and their families were encouraged to use the gym. So the gym was in a separate building, completely separate from the company, and it was staffed by professional gym operators, which was, I think, was a first. I've never heard of it before. And again, that would have been in the early 1980s.
So was PEC a dominant employer in Marton, and the workforce was living in Marton?
It did become dominant, because by the early 1990s, the staff had grown to over 300, an employer of 300 in Marton is a town that I think at that stage probably had about 3,000. So it was employing, say, 10% of the population.
That would be 40% of the workforce.
Yes, it wasn't the Marton workforce, because a lot of people travelled. A lot of people lived in Palmerston North and came across.
So if they were progressive in that way, what was their attitude towards, say, family people? Say, if you had a child born while you were working there, were you given a lot of leave time or flexibility with school events?
The males weren't. There was kind of a different attitude to the female workforce. The female workforce did get pretty... By the era, pretty generous provisions for when they had young children, or when they were having children, and then subsequently when they had young children prior to school. But for the males, no, there was nothing like that. We haven't progressed to that point.
And in the work, if you were doing this sort of innovative things and you're exporting, and so did you travel overseas with your...
Yes, we all travelled quite a lot, and we not only attended overseas conferences and in virtually everywhere right throughout Europe, in the States quite a lot, but we also had a policy of trying to get the engineering people, the people that were the product developers, out in front of customers. And of course, being exporters, mainly most of those customers were overseas, so there was a policy to get the product developers in front of the customer.
And I used to take part in campus recruiting, university campus recruiting, because when I worked at Massey during the graduate program, recruitment program, we used to have PEC come along. Did you go to all universities? Or?
I wasn't especially involved in it, but I don't think so. I think we might have gone to Massey and to Canterbury. By that stage, Canterbury University were putting out some very, very good electronics engineers. During the time I trained, back in the DSIR days, the engineering at Canterbury was very much to do with bridges and lathes. Wasn't a lot of electronics going on. So.
Okay. But you were an attractive place for new graduates, weren't you? Or you'd rather have people with some experience?
No, we certainly were open to taking new graduates. it became more and more difficult to attract the graduates to Martin. Most of the people that we were able to attract were in a similar situation to myself, where we'd perhaps married, settled down, started to have a family.
Yeah.
And so the bright lights weren't quite so attractive.
Yeah, yeah. Not for a stable base.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.